Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast that never uses the word freedom as a punchline. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, everyone, and especially happy joint birthday to the kids at the table.
Thank you.
And hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
You want to do that again?
Nope. It's fine. Okay. So on Thursday of last week, President Joe Biden did a rambly town hall thingy with Anderson Cooper at CNN as part of a longer answer on whether it was a good idea to be firing first responders who refuse to follow vaccine mandates, on which he said a very emphatic yes. The president also delivered this little nugget. Catherine, would you like to play the clip?
The two things that concern me. One are those who just try to make this a political issue. Freedom. I have the freedom to kill you with my COVID. No, I mean, come on. Freedom. Number one. Number two, the second one is that, the gross misinformation that's out there.
All right. I only lament that the rest of you listening to that clip won't hear the triple echo that we had recalling.
Yeah, it was Mandy like Moda Lou Gehrig. Delivery. Lou Gehrig talking about
freedom, freedom. Number one. Anyways, as we did last week with Bernie Sanders' comments about the poor media coverage of the social spending $1 trillion bill in Washington, I wanted to take Biden's complaint as an invitation to have a deeper discussion on the theme in question. In this case, the relationship with and tension between COVID policy and freedom, or even freedom. Maybe even starting by questioning the president's basic premise here and how that might be impacting the way that we talk about policies and such. So, Catherine, is refusing the vaccine at this point, let alone objecting to things like vaccine mandates and various masking requirements, is that the equivalent to exercising the freedom to kill people?
So Reason's own Ron Bailey has entertained this question, I think, pretty intelligently in our pages, even before COVID. And he asked the question, is the equivalent of not being vaccinated in a pandemic, walking down the street, just swinging your arms kind of wildly, and when you punch someone, that was an expected outcome and is therefore reasonably categorized as aggression or violence? And I think that is the most useful hypothetical to use here. But what that hypothetical hinges on is what the likely outcome will be of your unvaccinated status. And I think that we are now at a point in the pandemic where, especially in many areas with high levels of vaccination, people have the ability to protect themselves. Most people have availed themselves of that option. And I think the calculus really changes, that this is no longer the equivalent of assaulting people in the street to be unvaccinated. It now becomes something more like a failure of etiquette. It becomes something that is rude, possibly immoral, but no longer the business of the law, no longer functionally the equivalent of violence.
Peter, the beloved, if slightly overrated, California fast food chain In-N-Out Burger is now the target of a great media controversy there in that Democratic-leaning state because authorities temporarily shut down the only In-N-Out in the city of San Francisco, which has one of the strictest mandates out there. I want to read to you the company quote there, which is, "We refuse to become the vaccination police for any government. It is unreasonable, invasive, and unsafe to force our restaurant associates to segregate customers into those who may be served and those who may not, whether based on the documentation they carry or another reason, or any other reason. We fiercely disagree with any government dictate that forces a private company to discriminate against customers who choose to patronize their business. This is clear governmental overreach and is intrusive, improper, and offensive," end the quote. So Peter, what does it tell you, if anything, about our current political moment that we're more likely to hear like back to basics philosophical arguments from fast food burger chains than your median mainstream journalist?
I mean, In-N-Out has been right about so many things for so long. Is it really a surprise? Look, I have said over and over again on this podcast that I think nearly every adult should be vaccinated. There are some rare exceptions, like, for example, the drummer of Offspring, who was apparently booted from the band because he has an extremely rare autoimmune disease that has a history of bad interactions with vaccines. But those cases are really pretty rare. Vaccines work. They're just about the only thing that works to fight COVID. They reduce without eliminating your ability to spread COVID to others. They radically reduce the risk of serious sickness or death. But I also don't think that my preferences should be enshrined as federal or state policy. And I especially don't think that Joe Biden or any other president should be attempting to turn large employers into the public health enforcement arm of the federal government via some barely legal workaround from OSHA, of all places. Employers should be allowed to mandate vaccines if they want or not. And employees should be then free to make up their own minds about whether or not they're willing to work under the offered terms. We have a way to work these things out, and it's called a labor market. Some employers can say, you know what, vaccination is a condition of employment. And others might not say that. And then purchasers of labor and sellers of labor can negotiate these things amongst themselves. And that's how it should be worked out. And there's just, I think, this is a problem for private individuals and organizations to solve. And I think it is a real sign of how broken our politics is, that we just seem to have settled on an equilibrium where a bunch of society has decided that actually that's a problem for the president to solve. He's just Joe Biden. He's just a guy from Scranton. He is not the God Emperor of the Imperium, and he shouldn't be making those decisions.
Come on, man. Nick, is what does Biden's sentiments, particularly about freedom, reveal about his overall governing philosophy?
Yeah, that it's a secondary, tertiary, maybe even lower priority to whatever else he wants. He said that a couple weeks ago, saying it's, you know, this isn't about freedom. This is about, you know, doing what I want you to do. I do think, you know, to kind of extend Catherine's metaphor, at this point in the pandemic, and especially because we have vaccines that effectively immunize, like if you get the vaccine, you may catch COVID, but you are not going to get hospitalized and you're not going to die from it. So you can kind of relax and let other people do what they want to do. And it's, you know, there's some question as to whether or not having 100% of people vaccinated means that there's going to be mutations and stuff. But this is like if Joe Biden, 800-year-old man, was walking down the street swinging his fists and he manages to hit you in the face, the only thing that's going to happen is he's going to break his hand. You won't even feel it. So that's the kind of public health threat that we're at now. And I wish that that was factored into
things. I'd still be pretty mad if Joe Biden
you
just
wouldn't
happened
even
to
notice it.
Be walking down the street swinging
even,
his fists
you
and like
even
smacking
it.
My
yeah.
face accidentally.
You wouldn't even feel it.
I approve this metaphor extension, exactly. By the way. This is like a successfully executed
I'm taking the rest of the day off right. then. But having said that, there is a second part of what Biden is talking about, which is worth considering. You know, I have 2 points. One, the second part of what he's talking about is that there is a massive amount of misinformation out there about vaccines and about the health risks that are posed to vaccines versus the benefits of having them. I mean, essentially, very few people, unless you're over, you know, 65, very few people are going to get sick and die from COVID, no matter what. That goes to effectively absolute zero if you are vaccinated, you know, with a couple of exceptions, and there are some people who shouldn't get vaccinated. But it's worth maintaining that conversation because it is a good idea to get vaccinated. And, it, you know, the ways that we're going to increase the vaccination rates, which I've seen ranging, you know, that the vaccine rate for full vaccination is somewhere between 67 and 77% of Americans above the ages of 12. You know, the way that you're going to crank that up a little bit higher at this point is through suasion and through, you know, it's honey, not vinegar. I think there's something really counterproductive going on there. But people who are spreading absolute lies about COVID, about vaccines, really need to be held accountable, I think. You know, that's
I would like to
the other, a bad the reason other th- to avoid getting vaccinated is because Joe Biden wants you to get vaccinated.
No, but those people are idiots. I mean, they're doing it because Donald Trump, you know, and this is something like I don't think we need to worry about Donald Trump anymore, but it's like Trump, you know, helped enable the vaccines through Operation Warp Speed, and that's a good thing. But he totally dawdled on whether or not they were good or not once he lost the election, because then he had no interest in taking credit for anything. And it's, you know, and so there's a lot of really stupid people out there who are not getting vaccines. Like, if your reason not to get a vaccine is because Joe Biden is for it, you're an idiot, you know, and you're part of the problem. You're part of a larger problem that's going on.
Can we talk about, though, the specific example that this question was about? Because I actually think there is, I would put an asterisk on some of this discussion with respect to public sector workers, and particularly public sector workers that have direct contact with the general population. Because I think a lot of the case for allowing individual choice in vaccination is that people have individual choice in who they associate with. And you can do this very radically, right? Like, you can sequester yourself in your home. You can do this. You know, more, you can just sort of check the vaccination status of the people you have over for dinner, whatever, more casually, or you can do it formally and institutionally. One thing that no one has a choice about, though, is interacting with agents of the state. And so I think that the idea that we are, you know, in some cases seemingly okay with allowing less vaccination in those populations because of the power of the public sector unions, because politicians are scared of them. That is a population that I am much more comfortable with saying, like, listen, you work for the government, you got to get vaccinated, because people don't have a choice about whether or not to interact with you. If I get pulled over by a cop and I'm immune compromised and I didn't get vaccinated for legitimate medical reasons, I can't not interact with that guy. I cannot interact with a Starbucks barista, but I will always have to interact with a cop. And so I think in that case, actually, we should hold them to a higher standard.
I mean, that just goes back to what I was saying, which is that employers can decide whether or not to impose vaccination requirements. And the federal government is an employer and a purchaser of labor. And the federal government can, in fact, decide whether or not it's going to employ people who are vaccinated or not and make that a condition.
Peter, Nick mentioned, I think, vinegars versus carrots or something like that.
Yes, Matt, that is the vinegar versus carrots. Absolutely.
That's when you want to punish somebody
or you really want to punish somebody. Vinegars or carrots.
You can make a great bitters with one and a shrub with the other.
All right, kids.
To steel man, sorry for using a crap phrase, Biden's argument, and you hear a lot of arguments out there, so let's talk about it, is that the carrots are working. If you're getting 90%+ of compliance, is that not proof that this is working? And here is an example, and I'm going to kind of ask this two ways. One is that there's 96% of the employees at the New York City Department of Education have complied with the mandate. So see, it works. But also, 4% who didn't comply and now no longer have, that's 6,000 people. And we're starting to see in places where they're actually enforcing the mandate against police and other people who are tend to be a little bit more vaccine resistant, that they are seeing people leave their jobs willingly. There's I sat through the coronavirus task force meeting last week with Rochelle Walensky and Fauci and the rest of them. And the coronavirus task force chief dude, Jeff Zients, made a remarkable kind of answer, because someone was asking, like, hey, look, could there be disruptions in travel and other things because of these vaccine mandates affecting an already tight labor market? And he stated flatly that vaccination requirements will not impact holiday travel. Also, the bottom line is this: the requirements for federal workers and contractors will not cause disruption to government services that people depend on. Unquote. We all know people who have had problems in getting health care because of labor shortages, right? Haven't we? Or is it just me at this point? How can they possibly predict that given the super tight labor market?
I think it's not at all clear how much vaccination requirements will end up affecting labor availability or the supply of labor or services right now. It could be significant. It could also be fairly trivial, I think. And I just don't think you can predict it one way or the or another. And it just goes back to the point that I've now made a couple of times, which is that public employers are employers. They can decide the terms of employment. And if they think it's a problem and they think that they are not able to provision the services that they want to provision or hire enough people, then they can reverse course and they can make different decisions. But they are employers just like AT&T or Apple is an employer, and they should be, and the federal government and the public sector should be able to make those decisions and decide which terms of employment they want to hire people on. And if workers don't want to do that, then they can find other jobs. And that includes people who are working for public sector unions.
Catherine, if there was 99% compliance to the OSHA mandate, 99.9% compliance with that, would that make it worth it?
I don't think so, in part because it's not clear we need 99% compliance for the vaccine to be effective. And, you know, I also think that there's some polling that shows that people who are still getting vaccinated, some of them are doing it in response to the mandate, but others are doing it because of the same reasons that people got vaccinated over the last many months, because they read something about the Delta spike, or because they want to meet their grandchild, or because they had a scare and realized that they shouldn't screw around. That people are making the decision to get vaccinated for very complex reasons. And the mandate is only a small part of that. We will never be able to disaggregate that effect. And it really actually is deeply annoying to me that Joe Biden will for sure go around for the rest of time being like, that worked. And, you know, there are, of course, is evidence that mandates influence people's behavior. Of course, there is not a zero impact for this mandate. But right now, enforcement is all largely notional, or it's happening below the federal level. The enforcement of the federal mandate is still, I think, a big question mark for the most part. So, I think it's definitely too early to say specifically that the federal mandate worked.
A lot of large employers would have mandated vaccination for employment, right, no matter what, whether or not there was any sort of state or federal action on this at all.
Right. And it's just going to be hard to untangle that. I mean, to me, though, the underlying thing remains just, I think the reason we listened to that clip at the beginning of the show, like the deep fundamental misunderstanding of what freedom and pluralism and toleration look like. Like, it is not, like when I was a kid, my mom used to say, you have a choice. You can do it happily or I can make you. Like that was like a thing. It was like, put on your shoes. You can do it happily or I can make you. And that is a sort of hilarious and appropriate parenting technique. But it is in no way appropriate for a president to talk to adult citizens in that way. And that is what Joe Biden is saying. And that is what many before him have said. He did not invent this mode of discourse. But the idea that, you know, look what a good guy I am. I gave people a chance to choose the thing I wanted them to choose before I forced them to choose it. Like, that does not in any way exhibit any of the virtues that Joe Biden is claiming for himself in this case.
Nick, at the risk of asking you to think on your feet, not that you're not fully capable, but it's kind of a weird open-ended question. What is a way that we can use the ideas of the kind of principles and the reflex of freedom to make better COVID policy?
That's a great question, Matt. Yeah. I don't really have what I'm thinking about in a lot of this stuff, though, is the reason why vaccination is controversial, I think, is partly because of the way that mandates have been, have been implemented in various ways, mask mandates as well as vaccine mandates. At the state level, the distinctions being made early on between essential and non-essential businesses and things like that, which were totally arbitrary, the complete failure of public health authorities at every level to either speak clearly and to acknowledge the limits of what they knew when they knew it, or that they had reversed courses. There's so much going into kind of pushback against any kind of mandate. But there's also a question about the polarization of politics, because I've mentioned this a couple of times. There were studies done of vaccine hesitancy done in the early aughts, or rather in the early teens, and it showed that people who identified as liberal and Democrat were a little bit more likely to be vaccine hesitant than conservatives. a lot of this stuff is simply because Trump said this, so Democrats believe this. Democrats say this, so Republicans are going to push back on that and things like that. And, you know, it's worth talking about that kind of stupidity and banality that comes into, you know, a significant portion. Right now, according to Kaiser Family Foundation, about 23% of people have said they haven't gotten at least one shot and they're unlikely to. Some might if it's mandated, et cetera. But what do you do to move that needle? Because even if the government, the federal government, which doesn't have the right constitutionally to enforce this kind of mandate, but even if they try to, it's unlikely to work. So what's a pragmatic solution to a bunch of this stuff? And I don't think what Joe Biden is doing and his denigration of freedom as a meaningful value is only going to make it more difficult to go from 23% to, you know, 5 or 10 or whatever it might actually get to.
Catherine, last week at the aforementioned coronavirus task force meeting in the White House, Rochelle Walensky was asked, like, hey, are you going to give parents a cookie if they vaccinate their 5 to 11 year olds, since that is likely to be approved sometime soon? And like, you know, maybe that's an occasion to withdraw some mask mandate recommendations. And she explicitly said, no, we can't become complacent. Got to keep those masks on. I just want to know, Catherine, was it just me who had a blood pressure issue after that was stated? Am I just a little bit too wound up tightly? Or did you, as a parent of kids, also react with some despair?
Yeah, as I've said many times on this podcast, I will be vaccinating the bejesus out of my children the minute that I have the opportunity. But also, I think actually this is an answer to your open-ended question to Nick. How do we harness the desire for freedom and autonomy in our COVID policy? And one answer is, like, let people make trade-offs. Like, if you get vaccinated, do you get anything you want? Do you get anything good? And like, the thing that I want the most right now is for my children to be unmasked. That is what I want. Like, that's my current desire. I want people to not die of COVID, first and foremost. And I want my children not to have to wear these disgusting, stupid masks in school with other children who are also at low risk for bad outcomes from COVID. So, like, give me a stop with the vinegar and give me a carrot. Like, I want
honey. Let's go with honey, which is a carrot is like another form of vinegar.
DC in particular has really chosen the both and school of COVID suppression. It's vaccination and masking everywhere, always, forever and ever. And, that has also been the norm.
I would actually say that DC has chosen masking over vaccination,
right, repeatedly,
in some cases.
Yep.
And for example, there's, as I've said before on this podcast, there's a consortium of gyms in the Washington, DC area that have said, look, what we want to do is impose a private vaccine mandate, but not be subject to the mask mandate. Because right now, if you go to a gym in Washington, D.C., you are required to wear a mask the entire time you're in the gym, unless you're in the shower. And Mayor Bowser has said, no, we're not going to do that. And so even though if you go to any restaurant or music venue right now, no one is wearing a mask in a meaningful way. You have to put on a mask basically to walk from the hostess stand to your table and then to walk out the door. It's completely ridiculous that they make you bother with masking at all in that circumstance, because there's no way that it is effective at all. But in a gym, you've got to wear a mask because the mayor says, oh, wait, we're not doing any exceptions. And so the gym consortium has said, look, please let us do vaccination, which is far more effective, and also give us the exception for people who have water bottles, which is an exception that every music venue, every bar, and every restaurant is currently operating under, because there's absolutely no enforcement of this stuff. And the mayor is like, has just said, absolutely not, we're not going to do it. And it's totally bonkers. And again, I'm someone who thinks that masks can work in the right setting, used properly, but it's just not obvious at all. There's very, very little evidence that mask mandates, which end up promoting a kind of half-assed, crappy use in which sort of it's a minimum level of compliance that people end up doing for themselves. And there's just no evidence that that mask mandates, that requirements from state or local governments actually reduce the spread of COVID or death.
Before we leave the topic, I just can't leave on the table President Biden's comment about misinformation without pointing out that even last week, Rochelle Walensky was talking about how studies have shown that masks, people who are wearing masks in schools are 3.7 times, you know, more likely to not get it or something like that. Just Google Jacob Sullum on this topic about the way that the CDC has misrepresented, not just the CDC, also the education secretary and a bunch of other people besides, have misrepresented the underlying data about mask effectiveness in schools, of which we don't have a rich set because it's hard to do control groups, to the extent that the people, the authors of the study, are just immediately tweeting at them like, oh, no, you're using my study wrong. That's not a conclusion that we came up with. Stop it. So yes, misinformation is a big problem. And no, it's not a one-sided problem. And in many ways, having misinformation come from the White House, come from the federal government, the Centers for Disease Control, does more damage, I think, than misinformation in other spheres. All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, living in a digital age where your personal data is always being probed by giant corporations and various smaller ne'er-do-wells, you would think that online privacy was a thing of the past. But I am here to tell you that it is not. There is a better way to protect your information and privacy without worrying about the prying eyes of big tech mining and stealing your private information. Introducing Secure, encrypted instant messaging and secure email service hosted in Switzerland, where the world's strictest data privacy laws are in effect. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from the invasive Cloud Act and other laws that violate your privacy. Your email and instant messaging services will be safe from big tech platforms such as Amazon Web Services, Facebook, WhatsApp, Microsoft, Google. You can take back your privacy and online security today with Secure. Here is how to do that. Visit secure.com. That is S-E-K-U-R.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Keep them coming to roundtable at reason.com. And be on the lookout very soon for some exciting opportunities for bonus interaction with the Roundtableistas to be held in conjunction with Reason's annual webathon. Anywho, this one comes from Matt B. in College Station, Texas, which is an appropriate place since it's more homework for Catherine here. It's 2 weeks in a row. Here we go. I have been having difficulty grappling with the arguments that the left relies on, indicating sales taxes are regressive and income taxes can be designed to be more progressive. The argument against sales and VAT, value-added taxes, are that they lead to higher cost of goods that low-income workers rely on. A simplistic viewpoint of taxes in economics dictates that all taxes are eventually paid by the consumers of products. This view implies product prices are adjusted to maintain profitability, regardless of whether the tax burden paid to the government is a multiplier on the compensation of labor, value added to the goods, or total sales cost. If that understanding is true, I am missing the argument that any of the taxes are more progressive or regressive on the basis of causing a higher cost of goods. A counter-argument could be made that income taxes weight compensation of labor more heavily against the value of materials when viewed as the total tax burden that is passed on to consumers. Since the ultra-wealthy don't rely on labor wages to grow in wealth, but rather the growth in value of their businesses and investments, this should highlight that income taxes affect the wealthy the least. Are these arguments wrong? And are there better arguments out there to help steer the left parties away from income taxes? Sorry for the length, but kind of hard to edit it out. Catherine, more homework. How do you answer?
I mean, that's a very good analysis. That's like a very, very solid analysis from our letter writer. So I think that, you know, the first answer is like, yeah, you've basically got it here. But the specifics matter, right? You are describing a bunch of effects that move sometimes in tandem and sometimes against each other. And if your goal, as unfortunately the goal is of so many, is essentially to extract as much money to fund the government as you can from very, very rich people, then I think that the trouble with that argument, the reason that it's not persuasive in these conversations you might be having, is because what you are talking about is trying to understand how the economic system underneath what we see functions, and what other people are talking about is like, what is the most efficient way to extract money from rich people? So it may just be you are sort of looking at different goals. My argument, though, against income taxes is actually, it's sort of the opposite of your letter. It's just a very, very, very simple analysis, which is we shouldn't tax the stuff that we want more of. That's it. That's it. Like, we want people to work. And again, there may be some subset of people that you're talking to, especially in the kind of Gen Z American left, that are like anti-work, that are like, no, we don't want people to work. I'm not one of those people. So I think basically we would think work is good and we want people to do it, which means you shouldn't tax that thing. You should tax other stuff that more correctly lines up with behaviors you want to see. Now, of course, that puts you on a slippery slope right down to sin taxes. Well, if the government should just tax things we want less of, like, who is we? And if we is Joe Biden, then he starts making a list of things that he doesn't think people should do and taxes them. That is suboptimal in my view as well. So we kind of muddle through, and something like a consumption tax is the messy middle. And so that is why I think many, many libertarians, myself included, see that as one of the least distortionary and least disruptive taxes. Of course, my real answer is taxation is theft.
Suderman, do you want to put on your wonk hat?
I'll just say that while a lot of that analysis seems largely right to me, one thing it does sort of skip over just a little bit is that there is a ton of money to be taxed and raised if you're just looking at Americans like tax cattle, right? Which is how the tax, yes, which is not a good way to do it, but is how the designers of our tax system often look at American earners. There's a ton of money to be raised from people who are not quite wealthy. A category of people often referred to as Henrys, high earners, not yet rich. So think of your sort of think of your lobbyist married to, you know, a Facebook employee, right? Like, it's people, you know, families making $400,000 a year or so, right? So on the one hand, they're rich. On the other hand, they're not like people who typically have $50 million in net worth or something like that, right? They're not the super wealthy that are often talked about when we talk about the super wealthy, right? And so those people make a lot of money in income. And that's why the income tax is like, that is one of the reasons that the income tax is structured the way it is because the goal is to extract an awful lot of money from them. And if you look actually at tax rates and just at the percentages that people pay, in many cases, it's those folks who are making quite high incomes, but who do not have gigantic wealth, who actually pay the highest annual income tax rates.
Nick, I'm going to offer you three doors. One is a 19% solution. Two is kind of class rage. And then three is whatever door number three you choose.
A wheelbarrow filled with rotting cantaloupes, perhaps? Or a goat?
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, there are real benefits to a consumption tax, whether it's a VAT tax or a sales tax, particularly that it's visible at the point of purchase. So you know what the tax is and you can adjust your behavior accordingly. It's very hard to do that with any kind of wage tax or income tax because it comes clipped before you even know what was really going on. The United States has, if not the high or the most progressive, it's one of the very most progressive income tax structures or tax structures in the developed world. So we're doing great on that. I think a more fundamental question about all of this is that question that Catherine was getting at. Is the point of tax to just squeeze as much money out of the economy for the government to use, or is it to provide the amount of compensation to the government for the level of services that citizens say they want? I would love to actually see us be taxed fully to pay for the $6 trillion a year we're currently spending at the federal level, because my guess there, and there's some economic studies from people like Bill Niskanen, the late Cato Institute economist and analyst, that if you actually, when people are faced with the full cost of government in terms of taxes, they demand less of it because the price has gone up substantially and they realize, I really don't need most of what I'm being offered here by the government. So I'm more, I think it's better to have a conversation about, what is the level of taxation we can, reasonably expect to get out? And, you know, this is since World War II. It's been a narrow band of about like 15 to 19% of GDP. That's the limit. We've been spending well over that, for a long time. Let's have a debate about, what this is the amount of tax revenue we've been able to squeeze out of everybody when income rates, when marginal rates are this, capital gains rates are this. It never varies much more than a 17-18% of GDP. That should be the limit of government spending. And then we can talk about other stuff.
I also always think it's worthwhile to ask the question, what would the world look like without government? Just because that makes you feel happy on a Monday morning, but also because it's a good way to then think backwards through what should we pay for and how. And that, I think, is the case for user fees, right? I mean, a tax on gas that pays for roads is at least a thing that makes sense. Now, of course, that immediately goes completely bananas in like 18 different ways, and people start raiding this fund to spend for that thing. And then somehow it's all just like trains that don't work all the way down. But I think, for stuff like retirement and education, there really is a good case for shaping our taxes to look more like user fees. And of course, if our taxes look more like user fees, then maybe people would say, hey, why don't we not pay taxes and just pay for the services we consume?
For sure, the income tax and related require a level of surveillance into individuals' financial privacy and also corporations' financial privacy that is, it just increases and is on the verge of increasing in a very significant degree right now with the reconciliation bill. And speaking of which, we have a little bit of time to talk about it, so I wanted to bring it up. Also, speaking of taxation schemes, the reconciliation bill, right, which is so-called because if the Democrats just say all agree on it, it'll get passed. This is the, 1.75 trillion or whoever knows the actual price tag at this point. It's being negotiated. It includes reportedly a provision to tax the unrealized capital gains on the super wealthy.
Oh, my God. So many things. The biggest thing that could go wrong is the thing that you were actually hinting at in your last answer, which is the invasion of financial privacy. If they build a huge new bureaucracy to ensnare what looks like maybe less than 1,000 taxpayers, right? Because this rule, as it is currently proposed, is just on billionaires. So it's just for billionaires. Their unrealized capital gains will be taxable. But they're going to have to figure out how to know what those are. And if anybody has ever done a tax return where they attempted to calculate even realized gains and losses, you immediately realize like, oh my God, this is so complicated and you have to pay someone to do it. And then it's still just making up numbers. I'm not making up numbers. My tax return is completely legitimate, IRS. But we are going to build a big bureaucracy to do the math for this subset of people on a category of wealth that is not, I mean, they're unrealized for a reason, right? Like these are often notional earnings. Like this is not something where like Jeff Bezos is out here like just running around with like his pockets full of his unrealized capital gains. Now, of course, very wealthy people have all kinds of financial instruments that allow them to take advantage of the existence of these unrealized gains, for instance, by taking loans. Still, we will build a big, dumb new bureaucracy, and you are an idiot if you don't think that big, dumb new bureaucracy is going to start sliding down the income scale. And maybe you're still like, boo-hoo, we're taking rich people's money. But you know what? If we're going to take rich people's money, we should just do that. Like, we don't need to actually build a massive new bureaucracy to do this.
We have that bureaucracy is in place.
And we are doing that, and we shouldn't do that. But again, I am very, very concerned about requiring the level of reporting and the huge new bureaucracy that this would create, because I don't think it is going to stay just a tax on billionaires.
So I think that there are practical unintended consequences as well, namely that if you get taxed every time you have an unrealized gain, but you do not get a deduction every time the thing that you own falls in value, then what that's going to do is it's going to strongly disincentivize.
I think you do, though.
What's that?
I think the proposal you would.
So the some of the stuff that I'm first of all, maybe nobody knows
know
what this
in the proposal
is.
Yeah.
Even if there is one that's written, it might change by the time this podcast is out. As Matt says, no one knows what's in this bill. I was talking to a Hill staffer this weekend who is intimately involved in these negotiations, and this person was just like, nobody has any idea what is in this bill, including the people who are supposed to be writing it. So we're going to discuss a version of this that may or may not exist. But if there isn't a deduction there, if there isn't sort of something that says that when you lose money on this, you get money back, then that's going to strongly disincentivize owning any kind of stock that is volatile. Now, if you do get money back, if that's built in there, then is it actually going to raise any money? Because these things go up and down all the time. And if they're constantly having to refund you on your unrealized capital losses, then that doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. And so just from a practical perspective, I think all of Catherine's points are correct, but this is just going to cause huge headaches in terms of the market, in terms of what people are willing to own.
And it will change the way people are compensated, right? So, there will be a whole industry that will spring up to figure out some way to convey and hold wealth that avoids whatever the letter of this law is. And I think this is, this gets back to the always relevant Nick Gillespie point that, like, no matter how hard we try, the government doesn't seem to be able to extract above a certain ceiling of Americans' income and wealth.
Yeah, I just want to add that I did a video a couple months ago about if you expropriated all American billionaires' wealth, you would fund the government for about 6 months. So the idea, this is not a serious proposal to increase the amount of revenue that the government takes in order to close annual deficits and reduce national debt, which at the same time, many of the people pushing for this are saying it doesn't matter anyway, because we're kind of moving into a modern monetary theory place where we can take on as much debt as we want. This is an attempt, which is symbolic, to punish people who have more money than is realistically is imaginable. I don't understand what it means to have, $200 million or whatever, $200 billion, whatever Elon Musk is worth now and things like that. All of this is symbolic, and it should be attacked on that level. This is not about paying for American government. This is sating some kind of bloodlust on the part of dumb Democratic Socialists of America and the people that they're flipping within the Democratic Party. The larger question is always, what is the level of government that people are willing to pay for? And I think foregrounding that again and again and pointing out that this is all, you can take Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk's and Kim Kardashian's and, Paul McCartney's money, if he's actually an American citizen, I don't even know. And it doesn't get you anywhere. Taxes should be transparent. They should be visible and they should be stable so that people can go about planning their lives while kicking in enough money to actually cover the government services that we somewhat believe that we should be getting.
And without going, you don't have to go full bloodlust here to just say, like, this proposal is essentially the equivalent of, the famous line about, like, why do you rob the banks? Because that's where the money is. Like, this is just, that's where the money is. Like, the billionaires have it, and we are annoyed. We, the government, again, is annoyed that they cannot access this pool of hypothetical money. And so they just said, let's change the rules so we can access that pool of hypothetical money. And it's just as simple as that.
It's worth noting, since Nick brought up MMT, that a core idea of MMT is that the deficit doesn't matter and inflation is the only constraint. And that if there is inflation, then Congress is supposed to raise taxes and stop spending in order to stop inflation. They're supposed to go into a contractionary mode. So we've got inflation right now. It is starting to become a constraint because we have spent an absolute boatload of money over the past year. And it's true that Democrats are looking at some ways to raise taxes, but it's actually turning out to be much harder than they thought. And there's been reports just over the weekend that they're going to drop all of the attempts to raise tax rates, that they had been talking about up until this point, just because politically this is very difficult to do. And they are very, very much not talking about going into a contractionary mode when it comes to spending. And so like the kind of the core theory about how MMT is supposed to work has gotten us a whole lot of spending. And again, you know, I don't want to say that Democrats in Congress have gone full MMT, but they are certainly operating like in the spirit of it and have been influenced by MMT thinking, I think. And it's just not working the way that MMT theorists want it to work and think it should work on a very practical and political level.
One of the things, at least for the past 40 years, and it might even be more, but all theories of taxation and economic growth are put forward in the interest, or ultimately what they end up doing is subsidizing low taxes and more spending. So, you know, the supply side revolution and all of that also, like nobody in power ever seriously contemplates cutting government spending year over year, which is the better way to get through a lot of this stuff. Certainly, it would be a way to kind of choke down inflation and I think increase economic growth. But this is part of the problem. And you know, again, we're in that, you know, shitty Star Trek episode where Frank Gorshin is white on one side of his face and black on the other, and the other guy is black and white on the other side. And, you know, everybody thinks they're saying that, you know, the same thing, and they see themselves as radically different. That's what government rhetoric is. It's always about, I will be able to spend more money and we'll get somebody else to pay for it. Maybe people who aren't even born yet.
All right, let's go to our end of podcast. What we have been consuming by asking Peter Suderman how many times he has seen Dune.
So I have seen Dune 3 times. Once at a critic screening a couple of weeks ago, once at home on my on my surround sound system in my basement, and then I saw it again at the theater over the weekend in a Dolby cinema at Georgetown. It's the best sounding theater in D.C. I chose this theater specifically because Dune is a great sound movie. It's great. It's huge. It's over the top. I just loved it, as you might guess from the fact that I saw it 3 times. And it feels like classic science fiction in a way that I just I don't think I've ever seen or in a movie before. The other thing about this movie is that I got to see it with Catherine Mangue Ward sitting right next to me. Catherine and I have known each other now for over a decade, have talked about so many movies for so long, and this is, in fact, the very first time we have seen a movie together, and so it was an added delight.
Yes, I am not a big movie theater goer, but I made an exception for Dune, which is also what I was consuming this week. Y'all, it was good. And I say this as somebody who has very, very mixed feelings about the entire Timothée Chalamet phenomenon. Like, I was really, jury was very, very out here. It didn't matter because it wasn't even about Timothée Chalamet. It was about, like, the soundtrack, which was like all the way inside my bones. And also my little, like, Peter's review of Dune is excellent, which I read after we saw it because I did not want to spoil anything. And I'm now going to include a minor spoiler here. So skip ahead 30 seconds if you don't want anything about Dune, a book that came out bazillion years ago, spoiled. I found actually the most moving part of the film was when Paul is about to make his first kill, and his mother says he's never killed a man before. And I had a like mother of a son moment where I was so sad for every man basically in all of human history before the modern era who had to make a first kill. Like I like went deep on this, y'all, and I was not expecting that, but it made me really appreciate civilization, and of course, one of the themes of Dune, which doesn't come out a lot in the movie, but maybe will show up a bit in part two and shows up actually in later books, is, you know, the fact that this is a society without thinking machines due to the Butlerian Jihad, for those of you who have already stopped listening, I'm sorry, a computerless society, a post-robots society, is something that I find just a very fascinating thought experiment. And this let me live in that thought experiment for a
little
longer.
I believe in the book when that fight happens, and it's described somewhat differently in the book because Paul is having trouble fighting in the Fremen way because he's so used to shield fighting, which requires a very particular sort of style and movement. My recollection, I could be wrong, but my recollection is that the line from his mother at that point is, he's never killed a man this way before.
Right. I mean, so that's, I think, one of the reasons that it got me in the movie is because it was a little different from the book. And so there was tension, even for someone who had read the book, like, wait, And that was good too. So
he's more innocent in the movie.
I generally am grumpy about, you know, is the book different than the movie? I'm generally team book, and this movie actually I think did a great job of being quite loyal to the book so far. But that was one moment where it raised the question and then answered it very well.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
So what I read last week was Self-Care, which is a novel by Lee Stein, and it's about a bunch of people who work at something that is kind of like a Goop type network, maybe Goop meets Refinery 29 and a host of other things. It's a fantastic satire and parody of online culture, of self-help culture, of millennial and Gen Z self-wellness care and things like that. The characters, it's told from the point of view of three or four different characters who kind of trade off in their voices. One of the characters, and this just gives a sense of the quality of the satire, it's a woman who is the face of this company called Ritual, R-I-C-H-U-A-L. So it's, you know, you're both being rich, but you're also, you have your daily ablutions to make yourself feel better. And she's thinking back to when her mother was dying of cancer. And she says, she's thinking to herself, the closest we ever got was when she asked me to apply her advanced night repair serum to her face and neck. She did it. She won the battle against aging, dead at 57. It's a great and hilarious book. It is by far and away the best novel that I've read that's specifically about kind of online, extremely online culture, and a kind of insane attempt to, you know, remake yourself in a way that only matters on the public part of you, on your face, your clothing, your weight, and things like that. So this is the best book that I've read, best novel that I've read in probably a year, I would say. And so it's Lee Stein's Self-Care.
I appreciate it, Nick, that you're picking up our thinking about what it means to be a lady novels
the novel
and running with it. I'm sure you were there first and we'll be there,
you know,
last.
It has always, since its origins, has always been identified heavily with women, actually early women writers, but also women audiences, because it is, you know, it's fundamentally about manners and etiquette and about social, you know, kind of social interaction and social presentation. I find this book is just wonderful. Lee Stein is acidly funny. It's also a great book because you don't know, like, none of the characters really are redeeming in any way. Some of them are slightly more sympathetic than others, but they're all kind of assholes. And it takes a particular type of novelist to do that without then, you know, flipping an allegiance to one character and having that person grow in a particular way. There's a fascinating denouement that revolves around Me Too and things like that. It's a fantastic book of the moment. And it's, you know, the best novels tell you something about the moment you're living in. And I think this does in a very good way.
Let me finish my what I've been consuming. If those of you who listen to this podcast, which is probably most of you out there, might note that the opening music there is a winning kind of surfy power pop stuff. That's done by a band called the Brother Steve, who are friends of mine, and they have a new record out. If you like that song, which is called Angeline, they have a new record out called Dose on Big Stir Records, and it's just power pop, hand claps, hooks, harmonies, super fun. If you like that kind of thing, look into it. stream them on Spotify and throw them a nickel if you want to buy the new record. But I like it a lot. It fills me with lots of happiness and also joy, which are somehow different. Anyways, that's all the technical jury rigging we have time to do here. And apologies for that, especially to our wonderful editor, Ian Kaiser, and other people. And we'll catch you next week in normal recording mode on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Look at all of our podcast products at reason.com/podcasts. Goodbye.